Every great wisdom tradition has some sort of value for stillness and for silence. And in modern times, stillness and silence can be really hard to come by. It's like there are so many voices vying for our attention, and the stories that do get amplified aren't always the truest or most complete. And silence and stillness can feel out of reach. It's been about a year since I've shared here on this particular podcast feed. And while my world hasn't been silent over the past year, there has been a good bit of stillness. And what I love about stillness and silence and space in general, quiet, is that it creates room for us to clarify things, to clarify who we are, to clarify our unique work in the world. When we make room and we're able to declutter, we're able to get clear. And so it's been a year since I've shared on this podcast feed, and I've changed a good bit, and my work has changed, and I'm still really passionate about supporting people who are on their journeys of creating a healthier, better, stronger, more loving world. And so my name is Bethany Wilkinson. It's been a long time since I've shared with you, and you are most welcome to my new podcast, A More Beautiful Way. Hello, hello. Welcome to A More Beautiful Way. This is a podcast dedicated to slowing down, creating sacred space, and bringing healing hearts, minds, and bodies to the work of social change. My name is Bethany Wilkinson. I am your host. I am the author of The Diversity Gap, Where Good Intentions Meet True Cultural Change. I am a facilitator supporting organizations and teams as they are on their different journeys towards embodying greater racial equity and racial healing in the world. I'm also training to be a spiritual director and a breathwork facilitator. So healing and spiritual vitality are huge parts of my work. And as you'll learn today, I've been on a journey over the past few years of really reimagining, redefining, giving new life and language to what it means to show up in the world in liberatory, healing ways. Some of you may be listening to this episode because you are subscribed or were subscribed to the Diversity Gap podcast. Some of you might be here because someone sent you a link or because you found out about this project through my Instagram or through my email newsletter. However you got here, you are most welcome. And my deepest hope and prayer is that some piece of the content and conversations that I will be sharing here meet you where you are, with connection and with grace and with inspiration. And today's episode is no different. So here's what you can expect. A More Beautiful Way is a podcast and a project. And really, it's been going on behind the scenes probably since spring of 2022. I did some experimentation with some conversations. I started blogging and writing about A More Beautiful Way over at Substack, which I will link here in the show notes. But what you can expect going into the future is that right now you're going to hear a two-part conversation where my dear friend Margaret interviews me about how my work has evolved from the Diversity Gap to now. She does a really great job of mining my story, my backstory for just details, for my values, for my family of origin details that shape who I am as a facilitator, practitioner, content creator, etc. And then we really get into some of the bigger picture questions I've been asking just as a human living in the United States in 2023. Really big themes that I'm really excited for you to dig into. A good bit of vulnerability and gosh, I'm just pumped to share it with you. So that's what you can expect over the next two episodes. But into the future, I'm interviewing artists and creatives and entrepreneurs and writers and thinkers and healers about what a more beautiful way means for them. What does it mean to slow down? What does it mean to create sacred space? What does it mean to bring healing hearts and minds and bodies to the work of social change, to the work of social impact? I have a really, again, incredible lineup of conversations ready to share with you. I'll be dropping them weekly in the days and weeks and months to come. And so that's what you can look forward to. For today's conversation, I do want to note that Margaret and I recorded this at her kitchen table, which I love because, you know, the best conversations happen over meals, which is great. Even though she and I were not eating, we were at her kitchen table. And so it's not like perfect studio audio quality, which I do regret a little bit. But it's also just real life. And as you'll hear as a theme in these conversations, if it doesn't work in real life, then I question if it actually works at all. And so we were at her kitchen table. You might hear us bump the table every now and then, or you might hear a phone vibrate or one of us take a sip of water. Those things are just happening in the background. So I wanted to alert you to that. Let me check my notes here for anything else. I guess the last thing I want to say is that it honestly feels a little strange for me to share this two-part interview of myself, like my friend Margaret interviewing me, because it can feel really like navel-gazy and like ego-driven in a way that I don't love. But I do believe that transparency is important. I want you to know who your host is as you're listening to these episodes. But number two, I do think something powerful happens when we hear one another's stories. It helps us to make connections and to articulate things in our own lives and experiences when we hear someone else talk about how it showed up for them. And so in that way, I do hope that this two-part series isn't just Bethany hour, but that it really is meaningful for you and that you're able to draw some important connections to your own life and community and leadership and things like that. And so I think that is all I will say for now, because really the interviews themselves have everything you need to know in them. But I'm really glad you're here. If you are, again, new here, if you were like a ride or die fan of the Diversity Gap, this is a little bit different, but I hope that you'll stick around and I hope that you'll give this new project a chance, because I think that it is full of just as much support and encouragement and practical application as the Diversity Gap podcast was. And so I'm glad you're here. And without further ado, enjoy this conversation between me and my dear friend, Margaret.
All right, so here we are.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. Experiencing a more beautiful way together.
So good. Love that. Where do you want to start?
Okay. Well, this is your podcast.
Sure, fair.
Your podcast.
So let's maybe tell the people who we are.
Yes.
Okay, I'll go first. I'm Bethany. I am a facilitator and a spiritual director in training. And I used to lead a project called the Diversity Gap, which is why this conversation is likely in these people's ears. But now I lead a project called A More Beautiful Way. And we thought we'd sit down and talk about the shift and some backstory, and weave some meaningful threads for the people. Yeah.
So good. I'm Margaret Reynolds, longtime friend of you, Bethany. And we were chatting about all your work, where it's been, where it's going. Could we take this podcast and weave it into the other? And my wheels got turning because of knowing your story, because of knowing you through all these different seasons of your work developing and influencing me and different communities, and knowing how you think about it now, I thought you need to tell your story. You need to, so much of it is rooted in how you grew up, where you grew up, what you learned here and when, and these communities you were a part of really has made this beautiful holistic story that you're telling now. But you're often interviewing other people and telling other people's ideas and, you know, weaving this stuff together for your audience. And I remember just saying, hey, you need to tell your story, you can either just sit at the mic and do that by yourself, or someone could interview you. So you, the tables have turned a little bit today.
Yeah.
And then you asked me to do it.
Yeah. I mean, for all of those reasons, yes.
And of course I said yes, because I love hanging out with you. So easy yes about why we would get together as friends. Mm-hmm. And I think some of too, why I love, I'm excited for you to get interviewed, because I've seen you facilitate so many things. We've done it together. Because you're such an incredible speaker. When you speak, it is this beautiful thing to watch. You weave stuff together. You just, all these ideas come together at the end, and you have this wonderful energy, and it's so fun to watch. And you think, oh my gosh, that's the magic. But then there's always Q&A time, and then people throw you curveballs and questions out of left field, and then that's the real magic, where it's like, oh, this stuff's just popping out right now. The on-the-fly stuff. Mm. So I'm excited because I get to ask the questions and you get to just
say whatever comes to mind.
Yeah. You get to just do your little Bethany magic. So I'm excited to see where it goes, where we go. Because I do know a lot of your story, but I don't know all of it.
Sure.
And so, and I know what big pieces have influenced you, but I'm excited for you just to get a chance to tell your story.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking too about those who are listening. Like, I'm always thinking as a content creator, as a writer, like, how does this land? How does this connect with people who are listening? Yeah. And I think stories are really important. Mm-hmm. So if nothing else, it's like, maybe I'm listening to a little bit of my story. People feel encouraged to weave more of their own stories into who they are and into how they're showing up in the world. That's my hope.
Yes. And I love that too, because that's how you teach. Mm. Even when you're teaching concepts, you're teaching something about, you know, about race, or it's about conflict, or it's about whatever. There's these ideas and there's these practices and things that are important, but you're always at the end or at some point saying, but you have to, this has to actually connect with you as a human in your location, in your real life. It can't just be an idea.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, which you have done. And it does make the work more beautiful and more rich. So anyways, that's the hope, is through sharing, hearing more of your story, Bethany, understanding how all this big jumble of stuff has happened through your life, things that have influenced you, things that have stood out to you, become important to you, even just as yourself walking through the world, being a really important leader. To make that leadership sustainable, make your work actually meaningful, to live a life that you actually love, and to be the type of person that you want to be in the world. The scope really has just grown so much since the early days of, you know, conceiving the diversity app.
Yeah.
All those pieces were there, but I don't think you knew where it would go.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until now. Mm-hmm. So should we start diving into your story?
Let's do it.
Okay. So everyone knows beautiful Bethany now, but tell us just a little bit about how you grew up, about your family, where you grew up, and what that, just paint us a little bit of a picture of just what that looked like, what that felt like, because some people have just, they've interacted with you only in like a boardroom you've facilitated for them, or you've flown across the country to lead something for them. They don't know really where your roots come from.
Yeah. And roots is like such a perfect word.
Yeah.
It really is. It's one of my favorite words lately. Yeah. So I grew up in a small town in middle Georgia. And my dad's a farmer. I've lately been saying my dad's a farmer, my mom's an artist, because I think those are their vocations. It's not always the thing that they've done for work, but that's like their primary orientation to the world. And so super creative mom. And then my dad, again, being a farmer. And so when he retired from the military, when I was 5, we moved to this little town. And I mean, small, like 2 to 3 stoplights. Everyone knows everyone. Even today, it looks just like it did 20, 30 years ago. And yeah, slowly my dad, we would like live in one house and then we would move to another house with a little bit more land and then mm-hmm. another house with a little bit more land. And then eventually by the time I was in like middle school, early high school, we were on this one property that had like 12 acres, which was perhaps the most my dad had owned himself. And so when I think about my childhood, a lot of it is like being outdoors, yeah. working, constantly working. Like even when we had like smaller pieces of land, it was like, it's Saturday morning, grits yeah. and eggs are cooking, get up. We got sticks to pick up. We've got rocks to move. Like even like when we were little,
yeah.
like 7 years old, like moving sticks and things and making brush piles. But then as we got more land and as I got older, lots of animals were added to that. So, you know, goats and sheep and chickens and pigs, and my dad hunts. And so that was a big mm-hmm. part of our life. Just rural Southern living. I don't even know if there's any other way to really frame it. It's just, I lived on a farm
yeah.
as a kid, but being in a small town, I also felt like my imagination was much bigger than my town. And so I yes. had this like huge desire to leave. And it wasn't like, oh, I hate it here. Yeah. Like one of my siblings, I feel like that's kind of where she landed. Like, I hate this. I'm never moving back to a place like this. For me, and I would say even for my younger brother, it wasn't like a hatred. It was just like the world's bigger.
Yeah.
And I want to go see it. And mm-hmm. I want to go learn. And I want to go change the world, whatever it might be. So that's a little bit more about like my roots, my background. And
you have several siblings. Where do you land?
Yeah. So I'm number 4 in birth order mm-hmm. Out of 5.
Yeah.
And so I'm the baby girl, but not the baby.
Right.
Yeah. yes. Mm-hmm. It's brother, brother, sister, me, brother. Yeah.
That's a lot of kids.
It is. And then my parents were foster parents.
Yeah.
For most of that upbringing as well. So lots of siblings and kids in and out. And most recently, I'd say maybe 2 years ago, they got legal guardianship of 2 teenagers. So I also have another younger sister and younger brother who came into our life a few years ago.
Sounds like a very full house, full life.
It is.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
So talk about school and like your own, finding your way in your own community and friends, mm-hmm. moving houses, being in a small town, like mm-hmm. whether that was school, activities, what was like your social world like?
Oh, yeah. Fun. Yeah. So even though we moved all over this little county and town, it was one school system. Mm-hmm. There was like the one primary school, the one elementary school, the one. So we're all together.
Yeah.
Most of the people I graduated with, I'd known since I was 5 or 6 years old. And so my social life, let's see, I loved school. It was very nerdy. Also loved band. So band was like the highlight of my life. I played flute and piccolo and then I was drum major. And so
yes.
the band kids were like my home base. My band director was my favorite teacher. I just loved band. I would say a few interesting things about school is that I was tracked into a gifted program when I was 7. And I was the only Black person in that program until I was like, I don't know, maybe until I was a senior, maybe a junior. And then wow. I was one of 2 people of color in that program. My best friend, she is Vietnamese American. And so my best friend from when we were in school, she was the other person of color in that program. And so, yeah, just a lot of, I guess my closest friends were mostly white, which is relevant maybe mm-hmm. to my story. And they were the ones I had the most proximity to through my classes and things like that. And then I had some pretty complex relationships with other Black students in my school because I often didn't feel like I fit in with them and had some painful experiences related to not being Black enough. And so it was just kind of confusing, but my way of coping, which I've sorted out a little bit in therapy with that, was like being excellent at my work. And so like I felt like I could really find my place through achievement and through getting as many accolades as I could. So like if there was like a way to succeed or excel or to achieve the best, then I would kind of, that's what I would do in terms of navigating my social life, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it was good. I like that I grew up there and I mm-hmm. like, I look back on the story and I'm like, oh, that made sense or that makes sense. And I had a lot of joy and connection and play and creativity. But I will say that the race the race piece was really hard too, because it being a small Southern town, there was a good bit of racism.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once this was later in high school, so I was maybe a senior at this point. There, I don't know if anyone remembers the brand Dixie Outfitters.
Oh yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do.
I looked up the website once. It doesn't seem like it's as poppin' of a brand as it was.
Let's hope not.
Let's hope not. you just never know, you know. But it was a really popular brand when I was in high school. And so I had this one acquaintance. We were kind of like rivals.
Ooh.
And she would always wear this Dixie Outfitters t-shirt. And I didn't make fun of her, but I would challenge her on it a lot. And like, what does it mean? And we would get into little arguments in class.
How
about
old were
it.
You when you were doing this?
I was probably like 17.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. But I started thinking about race really intentionally when I was like 15.
Like, yeah.
I have journals where it's like I was reading Why Are All the Black Kids Staying Together in the Cafeteria. I read Makes Me Wanna Holler by Nathan McCall, which is a memoir of this man growing up black in Virginia, which is near where my mom grew up. And so I've been thinking about it, and then being, you know, a younger, less filtered person, I talked about it with my friends and would argue with people about it if necessary.
Tell me, because I've known this part of your story for a long time and always heard you reference that sort of that moment, like beginning to read those books, being in high school. What was like happening in you? Like all these dynamics are at play with being a black family that's farming in the rural South. Being gifted, being in the almost completely white school experience as far as your classes, and then also feeling like you can't quite connect with people of your own race, at least at school. What was happening inside you when you read those books? What was going, like what turned on for you? What door was opened in your mind?
Yeah. I would say I was getting language for my experience, and I was realizing that my daily lived experience wasn't just mine, but like that there were people who thought a lot about this. I would also say that I was, I don't know, like maybe given permission to be angry about racism, especially reading like Nathan McCall's work. I can even in my mind see it now, this one journal where I wrote tons of quotes from his book, and he expressed a lot of anger and frustration and rage and disappointment. And I didn't know that I could feel those things. And so to have someone speak so clearly and plainly about their outrage was really helpful to me. It just gave me so much language, and it made me feel like I wasn't alone. It just made me feel less alone.
Did that like maybe pour a little bit of the fuel in the fire, like on that desire to learn more, get out, go connect with these other, you know, the people in the world that that maybe have had that other experience that you can be in community with, learn from?
Maybe so. I think also my parents, my dad being in the military, like he traveled a lot, and I don't have like a specific memory of my parents saying like the world's bigger than this, but I always had that sense like from my parents, like this is just one place. There's lots of places. This is just one way, but there are lots of ways. We didn't travel a lot when I was younger or anything, but I just feel like the energy in our home was like, read more.
Yes.
Do your best. Think outside the box. You're brilliant. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
That's really great.
So I feel like my parents kind of just threaded that there's a bigger world for you to explore into me when I was really young.
And so how did your parents like talk to you about race? And you know, they're like stewarding you, they, you know, they're living in these environments as well. And your family was, you know, in some ways unique, but also you had other people in your house, other children like filtering through. Tell me how were they talking to you about race and helping you navigate all of this?
I think a lot of the racial stuff I learned was caught, not taught explicitly. And so just being immersed in like their stories, mostly my dad's too, because we were living closer to his family. And my grandma and my aunts and uncles. And so a lot of it was just stories from growing up, and a lot of really painful, tragic stories, yeah. especially being from South, like deep South Georgia. People think where I live is deep South, but I'm like, no, keep going.
Keep going.
And you'll hit the deep, deep South. And so like a lot of the stories were indirectly communicating some things, right? Like
yeah.
white folks aren't safe.
Right.
Can't be trusted. Cause our family a lot of harm. But at the same time, like this sense of, I don't know if possibility is the right word. Hmm. Like I never felt like they weren't supportive of my friend group or yeah. like, yeah, I didn't ever feel like an active hostility towards white folks in my home or anything like that.
Yeah.
That I can remember in this moment anyway. I think the other dynamic living in a rural community was socioeconomic status. Hmm. And so from my perception, while my parents had more racial marginalization, they did not have as much socioeconomic marginalization as some of my friends.
Mm.
And that's just my observation. I could go talk to them now to see how yeah. true that is.
Right.
Because I don't know about my parents' finances like that. But it did seem that way. Like my family was better off in some ways than quite a few of my white friends, I would say. And so I don't know. I guess they, again, a lot of it was caught, not taught. There was a general sense of like, this is your story. There was a sense that I would have to work harder than other people. Mm. So that like knit that story, like work twice as hard for half as much. I never heard that, but there was a sense that like, if you want to be okay in the world, you've got to work really hard. You have to excel. You yeah. have to be the best. But I think they also pushed that because they saw that I wanted that for myself. If that makes sense. I don't yeah. feel like it was a universal rule for all of my siblings or anything like that. I think they wanted me to become whatever I wanted to be.
And they probably saw so much potential.
Sure, totally.
You know,
yeah,
as parents,
yeah.
you would just want to fan that flame.
Yeah, and I think they did that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question in terms of the racial
yeah.
stuff.
No, it does. It does. And when you, even just like, as an example, like if you experienced racism at school or out in the world, is that something you would readily like, explicitly come home and talk to your parents about?
Mm.
Like, were they people you processed those kinds of things with? Or was that pretty on your own?
I probably processed it myself in my memory of it. Because it just felt normal.
Right.
Yeah. And so, yeah, people using the N-word or like all the little microaggressions. I don't recall ever processing it at home with them.
Yeah.
Or even the bullying I felt from Black students. I don't, I internalized that and didn't process it either. I journaled about it a lot. I never talked to my friends about it. And I wasn't trying to keep a secret. I don't recall ever feeling like I needed to hide it or anything. I just processed it on my own.
Yeah. Almost sort of that this is an expected, you kind of are even already said this is an expected part of life. Mm-hmm. This is, your parents were telling you that. Like you can expect to be treated poorly in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Which is terrible and heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
So end of high school, you're this high achieving, you're on the, you know, you're on the gifted track. You're becoming so much more aware of your own racial identity and beginning to journal and have those, you know, that awareness of how your experience is different than even some of your closest friends and even being in the South, there's a socioeconomic part of it. And then you launch into college and you move into a very different location.
Very different.
So tell us about that.
It was so much culture shock. It was. I wanted to quit after my first semester.
You did?
I did.
I didn't know that.
I wanted to transfer to a Christian college after my first semester. Because we didn't talk about this as much. I became a Christian when I was 16.
Oh yeah, tell us. We did. Yeah. We skipped over that.
Yeah.
That's so important.
Yeah, it is. It's relevant. So a little bit of the church background. My family didn't go to church regularly at all. There was a brief stint when I was like 11 or 12 where we started going to a Black Baptist church, which my parents told me later was because my parents wanted me to have more Black friends.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. I love that. And so that was a brief stint, though, because it was really far from our house. It wasn't a sustainable rhythm, I think. But then when I was like 15, maybe 16, my mom started going to this church a town over. And she really loved it. And so eventually she brought me and my brother, and I loved it. Mm. It was like being in the South, mm-hmm. being in a truly multiracial church context was like wild to me. Mm. Like, of course I was a kid. And so I have since learned some things that my parents were experiencing that I didn't have eyes for because I was younger that were probably problematic, or that were problematic. But for me, as like a young person, I was like, this is amazing. Like, I adored every bit of it. I think there was something about the multiracial thing that just really like made me feel safe and feel seen. And then there were, of course, all the mystical experiences that go with that too. So I became, I would say, quote unquote, became a Christian when I was 17, where you like, you know, make the choice and you walk down to the altar and you tell everyone, you know, I've made this choice. Yeah. Like that was when I was 17. And I like to frame that up too, because I know for some people, I guess let me put it like this. It means a lot to me that I chose it for myself.
Right.
And that I didn't feel like it was expected or required, but it was like a very conscious decision I made. And that was empowering.
And what was the flavor of the church? Was, you know,
yeah.
Who was the pastor? You know, like, was it, because it's multiracial, so I feel like that's unique and important.
So yeah, white pastor, not from the South. And then what's the flavor? Oh, Pentecostal.
Pentecostal.
I was trying to find the word. Like, what? It came to my brain and then it left. And so, yes, it was a Pentecostal church. Yeah.
So for those of the, like, who don't know Pentecostal, what does that feel like, look
sure.
like? Because, you know.
It's like a party.
It's a party.
But that's how I experienced it at the time. Like, lots of music, clapping, dancing.
Was it gospel music or was it?
It was a combination.
A whole mix? A combination.
It was,
okay.
Yeah, it was a combination. But very lively.
Yeah.
Very passionate. Mm-hmm. Lots of shouting and speaking in tongues. No snakes, for those who are wondering. That's your only reference point for Pentecostalism, let me be clear.
Just a couple tambourines.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all we're pulling out of this box.
Exactly. But yeah, it's very Pentecostal, very free.
Do you remember what drew you? Like, what was like, ooh, I think this is, even if it's big and broad.
Yeah. I would say the, it's cheesy, but I was going to say the love.
Oh, that's not cheesy.
Is that cheesy?
No. Okay. The love.
The love. Like, people seem to really love each other.
Yeah.
Like, and like to be real, like when you're talking to someone, they are making eye contact.
Yeah.
They are asking you questions. They want to know about your life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they, like people seeing something meaningful in you. It was just a very loving environment. Mm. That's how I experienced it.
That's
full
beautiful.
Of love. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a good thing to be drawn into.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, other people's spiritual story is so different. You know,
it's, sure.
it's a little manipulative, or it's, you know, out of fear of messing
totally.
Up,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, but to be drawn by love is wonderful.
Yeah.
I love it.
Mm-hmm. And I hold it with like a bit of a double consciousness now, right? Like, there probably were some of those things.
Oh, of course.
You know what I'm saying? But those things did not stick out to me and they didn't mark me.
Yeah.
And I didn't experience it that way.
Yep.
I just felt really loved and really known and really championed by a community of people outside of my family and outside of my school.
That's so good.
Yeah.
If you are someone who is feeling a little burned out, like you don't have time and space to reflect on what's really going on in your life, if you are moving through transitions in your personal life, in your professional life, in your faith life, then I have two experiences designed just for you. On August 30th, I'm hosting a virtual contemplative writing circle. This is specifically for people who have a journaling practice or who want to cultivate a journaling practice through the creative art of writing and journaling with some prompts and some supportive meditations. We are going to go on a journey of making sense of what's going on in our internal world through the process of writing together. And so if you are interested in cultivating a journaling practice, if you already have one, if this is a skill that you want to cultivate in your life, then join us on August 30th for the Contemplative Writing Circle. Additionally, on September 21st, I'm hosting the Seasonal Examen, which is a seasonal quarterly reflective exercise for people who want time and space to reflect on the past season and to set intentions for the season ahead. During the Seasonal Examen, I offer contemplation exercises, some breath work, we do some reflection through some prompts based on the season that we're in, and then we close our time with group sharing and reflection. It's really beautiful. It's a super exquisite way to spend a few moments marking the time we're in the wheel of the year. I would love to have you there. That's on September 21st. Again, if you are someone who is feeling burned out, like you are moving through transitions personally, professionally, if you just need a little bit of extra room to tend to what's happening in your inner world, and if you want some space, some structure to do that in community with other people, then join us. You can learn more at the link in the show notes or by visiting BethanyWilkinson.com. Now back to the show.
Okay, so Bethany, okay, I love hearing your story so much because even knowing it, I've learned it in relationship with you. So it's like you hear this story and you hear that story, you know, over time. Mm-hmm. But then sitting here, you telling it in chronological order, it's all this stuff is sticking out to me in such a funny way. That I know about you as a person, I'm like, oh, this is where it came from. So just even hearing your about the intensity, the work, like ethic of both of your parents and the environment of your home, and you even just saying that the things that got caught, like knowing what got caught is, we're gonna, if, what did you just say?
If the sun's up, we are too.
Yeah, if the sun's up, we are too. We're working. Mm-hmm. You know, your dad's such a hard worker. He's still such a hard worker.
He's so hardworking.
He won't to stop this day. Working.
He won't.
And your mom just having plenty of kids. I have three. It's too much. But to have five and being like, and let's just have a few more just cycling through here. Let's just, and it's just so much. And then, like, knowing, I already knew you did the farming thing growing up, but like that's already in your DNA. And then you get into school, and of course, it's like, how am I going to find meaning, connection, significance, being excellent, working harder than everyone else? I think that's like already in you. Then you lump on the racial piece of like, I also feel like I need to work harder because of the, I mean, it's too much. And so knowing where you're about to talk now, going into like the academic world and, you know, transitioning your story to hear about like your college years and knowing you now, just how many conversations we have had over the years about like how much you're doing and the running in the background of your mind of ideas and stuff to do in the world and the feeling, the energy, the anxiousness of like, I'm not doing enough. There's always more to be done. And you spin in those wheels for years. It's like, oh, it just makes sense. You know, it's like already cut in your personality. Like you were saying, like, I like working hard. I like, you know, learning. I am doing these things because I'm interested in them. Also, you can wear yourself out.
Totally. Easily.
Oh my gosh. Oh, and it's just so interesting. It's like to look for anyone to look back at their story and begin to like, because anyone, we just all live in America, so we all get that message.
Totally.
But that unique like stew you grew up in to just really pour some fuel on that message. Yeah. It's very hard to untangle, which I know is what so much of why you're doing the work you're doing currently in a more beautiful way. It's like, oh yeah. This isn't a woman who just loves to lay around and be peaceful and meditate. This is someone who has had to work that stuff into who you are.
Yeah.
Because you needed it.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I will burn myself out every other week.
You really
if
do.
If I don't have friends who are calling me out on like me overdoing it or having some of these like rhythms and rituals that ground me. But it's taken a long time to even start the journey of integrating these things in a sustainable way.
Yes. Yeah. And so this is great. Even bringing this specific part of your story out, mm-hmm. going into college, because knowing, I mean, that's when I met you, mm-hmm. Is, I mean, that really was your vibe in college, was like, I need to be doing more. I'm doing a lot. I'm going to do a lot. And everyone around me also needs to be doing a lot.
Get on board.
Let's go.
We're going places.
And it was a great energy. I mean, I loved it. I met you. I was like, this girl's amazing. And so, and I loved it. I mean, I wasn't all that far from being in college myself. And I was all in, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Probably just fanned terrible flames. Like, yeah, go. No, you don't need to rest. This is important. So tell us about, you decide I'm leaving the teeny tiny town and I'm going to the big city.
Yeah. So fun. Okay. College. I moved to Atlanta for school, and there were like three parts of this. When I think about the story overall, there is the culture shock of no longer being in a small town and being surrounded by people from all over the world. Never experienced that before. Definite culture shock. And then there was like the just pure academic piece mm-hmm. of it, like all the things I learned. And then there was also my faith story that was unfolding while I was in college. Yeah. And these things were weaving together. But I kind of think of those as three different pillars. So yeah, moved to Atlanta, get into this really intense academic environment, and felt way out of my depth. Definitely feel like I wasn't good enough to be there, but was really happy to be there at the same time. Yeah. My first semester, I may have mentioned this already, I did want to transfer to a Christian school because I felt so out of my depth. And then my faith at that time was very like fundamentalist.
Right.
Which I didn't have language for, but it was. Mm-hmm. And so I think just being around people of different faiths and people who were queer and people who were wealthy, but also Black. It just, I didn't have a framework for any of those things. Yeah. I was like, I'm in the wrong place. I need to be in a place that's like Bible based or whatever. Oh gosh. so funny. And I think I even tried to talk to my parents about it and they were like, definitely not.
Did they really?
I feel like I don't have the, I think that's what happened. I think they were like, no. You need to be there.
Yeah.
Like they were like full fans of me not being in a comfortable environment. Yeah. And so bless it. I'm so happy.
I know you.
I needed to get out of all those boxes. Yeah. It was like really important, and really meaningful. So there's that part of it. And then I don't know what else would be helpful. Should I get into what I studied? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah,
sure.
Let's talk about, like what you got into. And I even would love to hear more about it, whether you pepper it through or talk about it right now. Just the, how did that knee jerk reaction to, I want to go back to a
conservative small place.
Like, how did that change? Like it you said it changed, but like how?
Yeah. Oh, I love that question. It changed. I think proximity changed it. I was like, this stuff does not make sense. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, these boundaries don't make sense. Mm. This, I would call it bigotry now. Mm. Didn't have that language at the time. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit. This person is not these things that I was told that this person would be. Like, it's just not true. And then I also had one of my really good friends from high school came out to me my freshman year also.
I remember you telling me that.
Yeah. And I felt so grateful and surprised that they felt comfortable doing that. Because I was like, you trust me with this information.
Yeah.
But also like, okay, some of this stuff that I'm believing really can't be what I thought it was.
Right.
And so I would say relationships changed that for me really quickly. And I feel like that is even a thread now when we talk about like race stuff going into the future. It's like when your ideology bumps up against like relationships with humans, like
real lived experience.
Like, what are you going to let crack? Like, are you going to hold the person in front of you? Or are you going to hold your, anyway.
Oh my goodness.
And so, yeah, I changed my mind about a lot of stuff really quickly. But in the midst of that, I took my first flight ever when I was probably 19. I probably would have just had turned 19 to Chicago.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Which was huge for me for the Chicago Urban Program. Mm-hmm. And it was like a week long spring break thing of like volunteering on the west side of Chicago. And that was the first time a lot of things converged, like my faith, plus a commitment to service, plus a commitment to racial justice. And the fact that those things were all connected in a way that was real, and that people had spent decades like living out this value for racial justice and equity in communities. It just like changed my life.
Yes.
And it was also, so I did the spring break trip, and then the themes that I learned there were kind of woven into the life of the campus ministry I was a part of. Mm-hmm. And then I did the summer long program. So that was like 6 weeks, 9 weeks. I can't remember now, but went back to the west side of Chicago for the summer. And that was probably my second flight ever. Mm-hmm. And I would say that was when it really came home in a way that lasted, that like God had an opinion about my racial identity. And that the pain that I'd experienced as a young person was important. If that makes sense. Like, it wasn't just an academic thing. It wasn't just a, oh, this is just what life is like thing. It was like, oh, this pain is here and it's real. And in the way I conceived of it at the time, like, God made me Black on purpose and that there's a purpose to this identity. And so that opened up like a healing pathway, I would say, that summer. Yeah.
And when you say God has an opinion, you know, on my race, like, what... Mm-hmm. Did you feel like that was? Like, what was the impression?
Yeah, the impression was that God loves Blackness. Yeah, and God loves Black people.
And you were how old?
19.
And that just makes me like, okay. So until you're 19, you didn't feel, like, feel that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You had to live almost 20 years of life to feel that. Mm-hmm. Wow. Explicit message from Creator, from God.
Yeah. Wow. I hadn't thought of it that way. But yes, definitely. Because there was no evidence to the contrary.
Right.
Or there was a lot of evidence to the contrary. That's what I mean to say. Yeah. Like, in my experience, I mean, there were glimmers, right? Like, my Black family is a place of safety and learning and growth. There was that church where I experienced a lot of love, but for it to be explicit, like, God made me Black on purpose. God loves Black people. God is fighting on behalf of Black people and for Black liberation, like that. And I'm using that language explicitly. Like,
I know.
Like, that was huge.
To not just be like, it's okay that I'm Black, or it's fine or tolerated, to switch to wanted on purpose, love, delight, and not just that, but then there's putting the energy behind that justice work and healing work, and that's really profound.
Yeah.
What a shift.
Changed everything.
Wow. Okay. So you experience very important work on so many levels, communities, socially, spiritually, just even in your own like self-awareness, and you're still in an intense academic program.
Yeah. So that experience that summer really changed what I wanted to study. So I decided to, I doubled down on like understanding sociology and then did educational studies, which the program doesn't exist anymore, but it wasn't like to be a teacher. It was more so about understanding the history of education. And then given my passion about race and racial justice, I had like a big racial justice lens to that learning. And so that's what I studied. And then I also added a community building and social change program, which was huge because it's something I've always valued, which I lose sight of from time to time, but I really value application.
Yes.
And like, things need to be practical.
Yes.
I can learn about quote unquote racial justice all day, but I need to see what this means in like real life on the ground. And my community building and social change program was incredible because we were over the course of a couple of years, like, I learned about asset-based community development. I learned about just different perspectives on like poverty alleviation around the world. While in that program, I went to Cairo for a summer, Cairo, Egypt, and studied, lived in a garbage village there for a summer. And then went to Uganda and Rwanda and studied like how people recover after, you know, histories of armed conflict and war and things like that. And genocide, I say it flippantly. Those are huge themes that I learned about by living there. But in the community building program, I also got partnered with a community organization based in Atlanta that was trying to help make sure that people who were graduating from sixth grade would actually make it to ninth grade, because they were finding that there was a huge drop off. People would leave middle school. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I said that correctly. Leaving eighth grade. Wanting to make sure that they did not skip going to high school. And so we got to build this whole program, and it was really the application of all of this justice stuff that I was learning about. Like, there are these gaps, there are these inequities. So what can a community organization do to support a specific group of people who we hope will continue their education in this particular neighborhood? Mm-hmm. And so that was really awesome. Loved it. It was like, I'm like going all over the city and I'm getting to know like actual community organizations and leaders. And again, it was the application of these lofty ideas for social change. And that was incredible.
Which is 100% always been true of you since I've known you, is like, we're learning something, we're doing something. You're like, okay, but how is this going to like actually impact change? Like, how is this actually going to work out here? And how is this actually going to impact there? Is, I mean, always.
Yeah.
Always been what you do. Just we talk about something, you come back with a stack of papers like, well, then here's the 6 month plan. It's like, oh, okay.
It's like, we've got to do something.
I love it. It's such a good, I mean, it obviously makes sense with all of these things. So Bethany, you just listed out so much stuff.
I do.
It's really different than my college experience, which was great. Mm. Different. Mm-hmm. From your vantage point now, looking back at young 20-something Bethany, mm-hmm. and obviously there's so much joy in your learning and these things are coming alive and coming together for you. But like, how would you describe, what did it feel like on the inside to you? Like, all this is so much rapid change, so much work. I'm over here. I'm in this country, mm-hmm. that country. I'm completing a degree. I'm doing all these mm-hmm. things. What would you, looking back,
mm-hmm. yeah.
say about how you felt?
Oh, I was an anxious wreck. I'm just, I don't know if you thought I was going to go there.
No, I'm honestly relieved, because I'm like, how can you do all that without being an anxious wreck?
It was the worst.
Yeah.
Like, I would have to wake up. I can be a pretty regimented person when I need to be. And so I would like the amount of planning I would have to do just to get through a week. Because like class, studying, all these things. I didn't have a car. And so like if I'm going to community stuff, carpooling, it was just a lot.
Yeah.
And so I would wake up, and then I was still a very faithful like follower of Jesus. So I had to have my morning quiet time.
All right.
And then I had all of my like Bible studies and like, I'm trying to like change the world. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
That's like its own school of thought for those who aren't familiar. Maybe we can dig into that more. But I'm just saying that was an added level of pressure on top of performing academically, on top of actually wanting to experience formation as like a advocate for social change and justice mm-hmm. in the world. So I remember some days I would wake up so anxious that having a quote unquote quiet time was literally just to like ground my nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have language for it at the time,
right.
but that's what I had to do. Like, I had to journal. I had this whole thing I would do. I can look back on it now. I would put God at the top of my paper mm-hmm. and I would put me at the bottom. And then I would write arrows of all the things I needed to give to God because I felt so overwhelmed.
Uh-huh.
And then I would write all the things I believed God was giving back to me to help me get through the day.
Uh-huh.
And like, I needed that practice.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I was just so anxious. I would say it reached a real breaking point when my junior year.
Mm.
That was the worst. That was the absolute worst. I would say that maybe I was depressed, though I never talked to anyone about it.
Yeah.
Especially the summer after my junior year. I mean, I was just so sad and like so burned out. And this is when I started to bump up against the limitations of my faith, because I kept listening to all these sermons on like anxiety that were so useless.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, pray more, more faithful. And it's like, that's not what I need.
Do some more stuff, Bethany.
Do some more things and you will feel less anxious. So I started to really grapple with that part of it.
Mm.
But it was so bad. And I think the thing that fixed it was that I left the country after that summer, because I was doing like my fellowship program the summer after junior year. And then my first semester senior year, I was in Uganda. And I think I haven't made this connection, but I'm making it now, that I think what shifted that season of depression was leaving.
And being able to just probably focus on one thing.
One thing.
Yeah.
In a new country. So I don't know anything, you know? And so I think, and that was with one of my best friends that she went to.
So great.
And so, yeah.
Because I'm imagining you're so many things compounding on each other. Already a hard worker, already trying to stand out. Already, you're just a passionate, like you care about a lot of things, which has almost been an Achilles heel for you at times. Mm-hmm. Like even your experiences even allowed for that. It's like, what if you go to Cairo and if you go to Chicago and if you go to Uganda and you're exposed, not just in theory, but firsthand with these like painful experiences people are having and lack of resources and all of this stuff, devastating things, you also kind of carry those burdens. Mm-hmm. So it's like, even if you're studying for a test in Atlanta, Georgia, you're also aware of these just extreme things happening in other parts of the world.
Yes.
Then you add on that you briefly mentioned this evangelical concept of also, we're not supposed to just be kind to our neighbor. We're also supposed to change the world.
The world. The whole thing.
The whole thing. The whole city. The whole, as always, the whole whatever. Which is your faith piece, which has also been a little bit of like that, that grounded time. But I'm sure if I was in that camp as well, I was just feeling I'm never doing enough.
No.
There, if we're saving everything, then there's always more to do.
Okay, so we are only halfway through this story, which is incredible because we've covered so much ground already. But again, I think I mentioned this in the intro, if I were to play the whole thing, it was 2 hours long, and I didn't want to cut too much of it because I think all of the context is really important for where A More Beautiful Way is going. And so thank you for listening to this first half of this conversation between me and Margaret. I know it's a bit of a cliffhanger, but you're in luck because part two drops tomorrow. And I'm really looking forward to sharing part two because it really gets into all of the nuances and textures that inform what A More Beautiful Way is, how it's tied to the diversity gap, what it means for justice in the world, what it means for our wholeheartedness as individuals. And it will set the stage for the many incredible conversations that are to come. So thank you so much for listening to this first episode of A More Beautiful Way featuring me and my friend Margaret. I'm so glad you're here. You can subscribe and learn more about A More Beautiful Way at amorebeautifulway.co, which is a Substack blog. You can also find out more about A More Beautiful Way on Instagram, and you can stay in the loop about all of the different offerings and events that I'm hosting at bethanywilkinson.com. All of this plus a transcript is available for you in the show notes. I will catch you here tomorrow. Until then, be well, friends.